This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, 2010, Odyssey 2 by Arthur C. Clarke. Copyright 1982 by Serendib BV. Narrated by John Stratton. This book contains 291 pages on 6 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. Annotation. A joint U.S.-Soviet space crew sets out on a mission to the moons of Jupiter to learn what happened to the spaceship Discovery and its captain, and to investigate the cosmic intelligence behind the mysterious monoliths discovered on the moon and in space. Sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey, RC 19164, bestseller 1982. From the book jacket. When 2001, A Space Odyssey, first shocked, amazed, and delighted millions in the late 1960s, the novel was quickly recognized as a classic. Since then, its fame has grown steadily among the multitudes who have read the novel or seen the film based on it. Yet, along with almost universal acclaim, a host of questions has grown more insistent through the years. Who or what transformed Dave Bowman into the Star Child? What purpose lay behind the transformation? What would become of the Star Child? What alien purpose lay behind the monoliths on the moon and out in space? What could drive Hal, a stable, intelligent computer, to kill the crew? Was Hal really insane? What happened to Hal and the spaceship Discovery after Dave Bowman disappeared? Would there be a sequel? Now, all those questions and many more have been answered. In this stunning sequel to his international bestseller, Clark has written what will be truly one of the great books of the 80s. Cosmic in sweep, eloquent in its depiction of man's place in the universe, and filled with the romance of space, this novel is a monumental achievement. This is fiction in the grand tradition. Beside it, even 2001, A Space Odyssey, is mere prologue. About the author. Arthur C. Clarke was born at Minehead, Somerset, England in 1917, and is a graduate of King's College, London, where he obtained first-class honors in physics and mathematics. He is past chairman of the British Interplanetary Society, a member of the Academy of Astronautics, the Royal Astronomical Society, and many other scientific organizations. During World War II, as an RAF officer, he was in charge of the first radar talkdown equipment during its experimental trials. His only non-science fiction novel, Glide Path, is based on this work. Author of 50 books, some 20 million copies of which have been printed in over 30 languages, his numerous awards include the 1961 Kalinga Prize, the AAAS Westinghouse Science Writing Prize, the Bradford Washburn Award, and the Hugo, Nebula, and John W. Campbell Awards, all three of which were won by his novel Rendezvous with Rama. In 1968, he shared an Oscar nomination with Stanley Kubrick for 2001, A Space Odyssey, and his 13-part TV series, Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, has now been screened in many countries. He joined Walter Cronkite during CBS's coverage of the Apollo missions. His invention of the communications satellite in 1945 has brought him numerous honors, such as the 1982 Marconi International Fellowship, a gold medal of the Franklin Institute, the Vikram Sarabhai Professorship of the Physical Research Laboratory, Ahmedabad, and a Fellowship of King's College London. The President of Sri Lanka recently nominated him Chancellor of the University of Moretawa, near Colombo. Other books by Arthur C. Clarke. Nonfiction. Interplanetary Flight. The Exploration of Space. The Exploration of the Moon. Going into Space. The Coast of Coral, The Making of a Moon, The Reefs of Taprobane, Voice Across the Sea, The Challenge of the Spaceship, The Challenge of the Sea, Profiles of the Future, Voices from the Sky, The Promise of Space, Report on Planet 3, The First 5 Fathoms, Boy Beneath the Sea, Indian Ocean Adventure, Indian Ocean Treasure, The Treasure of the Great Reef, The View from Serendip. With the editors of Life, Man and Space. With the astronauts, First on the Moon. With Robert Silverberg, Into Space. With Chesley Bonestell, Beyond Jupiter. Fiction. Islands in the Sky, Prelude to Space. Against the Fall of Night, The Sands of Mars, Childhood's End, Expedition to Earth, Earthlight, Reach for Tomorrow, The City and the Stars, Tales from the White Heart, The Deep Range, The Other Side of the Sky, Across the Sea of Stars, Anthology, A Fall of Moon Dust, From the Ocean, From the Stars, Anthology, Tales of Ten Worlds, Dolphin Island, The Lion of Komari, The 9 Billion Names of God, Anthology, Prelude to Mars, Anthology, The Lost Worlds of 2001, The Wind from the Sun, Imperial Earth, The Fountains of Paradise. Dedicated with respectful admiration to two great Russians, both depicted herein, General Alexei Leonov, cosmonaut, hero of the Soviet Union, artist, and academician Andrei Sakharov, scientist, Nobel laureate, humanist. Contents. Author's note, side one. Part one, Leonov. Chapter one, Meeting at the Focus. Side one. Chapter two, The House of the Dolphins. Side one. Chapter three, Sal 9000. Side one. Chapter four, Mission Profile. Side one. Chapter five, Leonov. Side one. Part two, Zien. Chapter six, Awakening. Side one. Chapter seven, Zien. Side two. Chapter eight, Transit of Jupiter. Side two. Chapter nine, The Ice of the Grand Canal. Side two. Chapter ten, A Cry from Europa. Side two. Chapter 11, Ice and Vacuum. Side two. Part three, Discovery. Chapter 12, Downhill Run. Side two. Chapter 13, The Worlds of Galileo. Side two. Chapter 14, Double Encounter. Side two. Chapter 15, Escape from the Giant. Side two. Chapter 16, Private Line. Side two. Chapter 17, Boarding Party. Side two. Chapter 18, Salvage. Side three. Chapter 19, Operation Windmill. Side three. Chapter 20, Guillotine. Side three. Chapter 21, Resurrection. Side three. Part four, Lagrange. Chapter 22, Big Brother. Side three. Chapter 23, Rendezvous. Side three. Chapter 24, Reconnaissance. Side three. Chapter 25, The View from Lagrange. Side three. Chapter 26, Probation. Side three. Chapter 27, Interlude, True Confessions. Side three. Chapter 28, Frustration. Side three. Chapter 29, Emergence. Side three. Part five, A Child of the Stars. Chapter 30, Homecoming. Side three. Chapter 31, Disneyville. Side four. Chapter 32, Crystal Spring. Side four. Chapter 33, Betty. Side four. Chapter 34, Valediction. Side 4. Chapter 35, Rehabilitation, Side 4. Chapter 36, Fire in the Deep, Side 4. Chapter 37, Estrangement, Side 4. Chapter 38, Foamscape, Side 4. Chapter 39, In the Pod Bay, Side 4. Chapter 40, Daisy, Daisy, Side 4. Chapter 41, Graveyard Shift, Side 5. Part 6, Devourer of Worlds. Chapter 42, The Ghost in the Machine, Side 5. Chapter 43, Thought Experiment, Side 5. Chapter 44, Vanishing Trick, Side 5. Chapter 45, Escape Maneuver, Side 5. Chapter 46, Countdown, Side 5. Chapter 47, Final Flyby, Side 5. Chapter 48, Over the Night Side, Side 6. Chapter 49, Devourer of Worlds, Side 6. Part 7, Lucifer Rising. Chapter 50, Farewell to Jupiter, Side 6. Chapter 51, The Great Game, Side 6. Chapter 52, Ignition, Side 6. Chapter 53, A Gift of Worlds, Side 6. Chapter 54, Between Suns, Side 6. Chapter 55, Lucifer Rising, Side 6. Epilogue, 20,001, Side 6. Acknowledgements, Side 6. Author's note. The novel 2001, A Space Odyssey, was written during the years 1964 to 1968 and was published in July 1968, shortly after release of the movie. As I have described in The Lost Worlds of 2001, both projects proceeded simultaneously with feedback in each direction. Thus, I often had the strange experience of revising the manuscript after viewing rushes based upon an earlier version of the story, a stimulating but rather expensive way of writing a novel. As a result, there is a much closer parallel between book and movie than is usually the case. But there are also major differences. In the novel, the destination of the spaceship Discovery was Iapetus, or Japetus, most enigmatic of Saturn's many moons. The Saturnian system was reached via Jupiter. Discovery made a close approach to the giant planet, using its enormous gravitational field to produce a slingshot effect and to accelerate it along the second lap of its journey. Exactly the same maneuver was used by the Voyager space probes in 1979 when they made the first detailed reconnaissance of the outer giants. In the movie, however, Stanley Kubrick wisely avoided confusion by setting the third confrontation between man and monolith among the moons of Jupiter. Saturn was dropped from the script entirely, though Douglas Trumbull later used the expertise he had acquired to film the ringed planet in his own production, Silent Running. No one could have imagined, back in the mid-60s, that the exploration of the moons of Jupiter lay not in the next century, but only 15 years ahead. Nor had anyone dreamed of the wonders that would be found there, although we can be quite certain that the discoveries of the twin voyagers will one day be surpassed by even more unexpected finds. When 2001 was written, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto were mere pinpoints of light in even the most powerful telescope. Now they are worlds, each unique, and one of them, Io, is the most volcanically active body in the solar system. Yet, all things considered, both movie and book stand up quite well in the light of these discoveries, and it is fascinating to compare the Jupiter sequences in the film with the actual movies from the Voyager cameras. But clearly, anything written today has to incorporate the results of the 1979 explorations. The moons of Jupiter are no longer uncharted territory. And there is another, more subtle, psychological factor to be taken into consideration. 2001 was written in an age that now lies beyond one of the great divides in human history. We are sundered from it forever by the moment when Neil Armstrong set foot upon the moon. July 20th, 1969 was still half a decade in the future when Stanley Kubrick and I started thinking about the proverbial good science fiction movie, his phrase. Now history and fiction have become inextricably intertwined. The Apollo astronauts had already seen the film when they left for the moon. The crew of Apollo 8, who at Christmas 1968 became the first men ever to set eyes upon the lunar far side, told me that they had been tempted to radio back the discovery of a large black monolith. Alas, discretion prevailed. And there were later almost uncanny instances of nature imitating art. Strangest of all was the saga of Apollo 13 in 1970. As a good opening, the command module, which houses the crew, had been christened Odyssey. Just before the explosion of the oxygen tank that caused the mission to be aborted, the crew had been playing Richard Strauss's Zarathustra theme, now universally identified with the movie. Immediately after the loss of power, Jack Swigert radioed back to Mission Control, "Houston, we've had a problem." The words that Hal used to astronaut Frank Poole on a similar occasion were, "Sorry to interrupt the festivities, but we have a problem." When the report of the Apollo 13 mission was later published, NASA Administrator Tom Paine sent me a copy and noted under Swigert's words, "Just as you always said it would be, Arthur." I still get a very strange feeling when I contemplate this whole series of events, almost indeed as if I share a certain responsibility. Another resonance is less serious, but equally striking. One of the most technically brilliant sequences in the movie was that in which Frank Poole was shown running round and round the circular track of the giant centrifuge held in place by the artificial gravity produced by its spin. Almost a decade later, the crew of the superbly successful Skylab realized that its designers had provided them with a similar geometry. A ring of storage cabinets formed a smooth circular band around the space station's interior. Skylab, however, was not spinning, but this did not deter its ingenious occupants. They discovered that they could run around the track just like mice in a squirrel cage to produce a result visually indistinguishable from that shown in 2001. And they televised the whole exercise back to Earth. Need I name the accompanying music? With the comment, "Stanley Kubrick should see this." As in due course he did, because I sent him the Telecine recording. I never got it back. Stanley uses a tame black hole as a filing system. Yet another link between film and reality is the painting by Apollo Soyuz commander cosmonaut Alexei Leonov near the moon. I first saw it in 1968 when 2001 was presented at the United Nations Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. Immediately after the screening, Alexei pointed out to me that his concept, on page 32 of the Leonov-Sokolov book, "The Stars Are Awaiting Us," Moscow, 1967, shows exactly the same lineup as the movie's opening, the Earth rising beyond the moon and the sun rising beyond both. His autographed sketch of the painting now hangs on my office wall. For further details, see chapter 12. Perhaps this is the appropriate point to identify another and less well-known name appearing in these pages, that of Cui Shun Jian. In 1936, with the great Theodore von Karman and Frank J. Molina, Dr. Jian founded the Guggenheim Aeronautical Laboratory of the California Institute of Technology, GALSIT, the direct ancestor of Pasadena's famed Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He was also the first Goddard professor at Caltech and contributed greatly to American rocket research through the 1940s. Later, in one of the most disgraceful episodes of the McCarthy period, he was arrested on trumped-up security charges when he wished to return to his native country. For the last two decades, he has been one of the leaders of the Chinese rocket program. Finally, there is the strange case of the Eye of Gepetus, chapter 35 of 2001. Here I describe astronaut Bowman's discovery on the Saturnian moon of a curious feature, a brilliant white oval, about 400 miles long and 200 wide, perfectly symmetrical, and so sharp-edged that it almost looked painted on the face of the little moon. As he came closer, Bowman convinced himself that the bright ellipse set against the dark background of the satellite was a huge empty eye staring at him as he approached. Later he noticed the tiny black dot at the exact center. which turns out to be the monolith, or one of its avatars. Well, when Voyager 1 transmitted the first photographs of Iapetus, they did indeed disclose a large, clear-cut white oval with a tiny black dot at the center. Carl Sagan promptly sent me a print from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory with the cryptic annotation, "Thinking of you." I do not know whether to be relieved or disappointed that Voyager 2 has left the matter still open. Inevitably, therefore, the story you are about to read is something much more complex than a straightforward sequel to the earlier novel or the movie. Where these differ, I have usually followed the screen version. However, I have been more concerned with making this book self-consistent and as accurate as possible in the light of current knowledge, which, of course, will once more be out of date by 2001. Arthur C. Clarke, Colombo, Sri Lanka, January 1982. 2010, Odyssey 2. Part 1, Leonov. Chapter 1, Meeting at the Focus. Even in this metric age, it was still the 1,000-foot telescope, not the 300-meter one. The great saucer set among the mountains was already half full of shadow as the tropical sun dropped swiftly to rest. But the triangular raft of the antenna complex, suspended high above its center, still blazed with light. From the ground far below, it would have taken keen eyes to notice the two human figures in the aerial maze of girders, support cables, and waveguides. "The time has come," said Dr. Dmitry Moiseevich to his old friend Heywood Floyd, "to talk of many things. Of shoes and spaceships and sealing wax, but mostly of monoliths and malfunctioning computers." "So that's why you got me away from the conference. Not that I really mind. I've heard Carl give that SETI speech so many times that I can recite it myself. And the view certainly is fantastic. You know, all the times I've been to Arecibo, I've never made it up here to the antenna feed." "Shame on you. I've been here 3 times. Imagine. We're listening to the whole universe, but no one can overhear us. So let's talk about your problem." "What problem?" "To start with, why you had to resign as chairman of the National Council on Astronautics." "I didn't resign. The University of Hawaii pays a lot better." "Okay, you didn't resign. You were one jump ahead of them. After all these years, Woody, you can't fool me, and you should give up trying. If they offered the NCA back to you right now, would you hesitate?" "All right, you old Cossack. What do you want to know?" "First of all, there are lots of loose ends in the report you finally issued after so much prodding. We'll overlook the ridiculous and frankly illegal secrecy with which your people dug up the Tycho monolith." "That wasn't my idea." "Glad to hear it. I even believe you. And we appreciate the fact that you're now letting everyone examine the thing, which, of course, is what you should have done in the first place. Not that it's done much good." There was a gloomy silence while the two men contemplated the black enigma up there on the moon, still contemptuously defying all the weapons that human ingenuity could bring to bear upon it. Then the Russian scientist continued, "Anyway, whatever the Tycho monolith may be, there's something more important out at Jupiter. That's where it sent its signal, after all. And that's where your people ran into trouble. Sorry about that, by the way, though Frank Poole was the only one I knew personally. Met him at the 98 IAF Congress. He seemed a good man." "Thank you. They were all good men. I wish we knew what happened to them. Whatever it was, surely you'll admit that it now concerns the whole human race, not merely the United States. You can no longer try to use your knowledge for purely national advantage. Dmitri, you know perfectly well that your side would have done exactly the same thing, and you'd have helped." "You're absolutely right. But that's ancient history, like the just-departed administration of yours that was responsible for the whole mess. With a new president, perhaps wiser counsels will prevail." "Possibly. Do you have any suggestions? And are they official or just personal hopes?"
"Entirely unofficial at the moment. What the bloody politicians call exploratory talks, which I shall flatly deny ever occurred."
"Fair enough. Go on."
"Okay, here's the situation. You're assembling Discovery 2 in parking orbit as quickly as you can, but you can't hope to have it ready in less than 3 years. which means you'll miss the next launch window. I neither confirm nor deny. Remember, I'm merely a humble university chancellor, the other side of the world from the Astronautics Council. And your last trip to Washington was just a holiday to see old friends, I suppose. To continue, Aron Alexei Leonov. I thought you were calling it German Titov. Wrong, Chancellor. The dear old CIA's let you down again. Leonov it is, as of last January. And don't let anyone know I told you it will reach Jupiter at least a year ahead of Discovery. Don't let anyone know I told you we were afraid of that. But do go on. Because my bosses are just as stupid and short-sighted as yours, they want to go it alone, which means that whatever went wrong with you may happen to us, and we'll all be back to square one, or worse. What do you think went wrong? We're just as baffled as you are. And don't tell me you haven't got all of Dave Bowman's transmissions. Of course we have. Right up to that last, my God, it's full of stars. We've even done a stress analysis on his voice patterns. We don't think he was hallucinating. He was trying to describe what he actually saw. And what do you make of his Doppler shift? Completely impossible, of course. When we lost his signal, he was receding at a tenth of the speed of light, and he'd reached that in less than 2 minutes. A quarter of a million gravities. So he must have been killed instantly. Don't pretend to be naive, Woody. Your space pod radios aren't built to withstand even a hundredth of that acceleration. If they could survive, so could Bowman, at least until we lost contact. Just doing an independent check on your deductions. From there on, we're as much in the dark as you are. If you are. Merely playing with lots of crazy guesses, I'd be ashamed to tell you. Yet none of them, I suspect, will be half as crazy as the truth. In small crimson explosions, the navigation warning lights winked on all around them, and the three slim towers supporting the antenna complex began to blaze like beacons against the darkling sky. The last red sliver of the sun vanished below the surrounding hills. Heywood Floyd waited for the green flash, which he had never seen. Once again, he was disappointed. "So, Dimitri," he said, "let's get to the point. Just what are you driving at?" "There must be a vast amount of priceless information stored in Discovery's data banks. Presumably it's still being gathered, even though the ships stopped transmitting. We'd like to have that." "Fair enough. But when you get out there and Leonov makes a rendezvous, what's to prevent you from boarding Discovery and copying everything you want?" "I never thought I'd have to remind you that Discovery is United States territory, and an unauthorized entry would be piracy. Except in the event of a life-or-death emergency, which wouldn't be difficult to arrange. After all, it would be hard for us to check what your boys were up to from a billion kilometers away." "Thanks for the most interesting suggestion. I'll pass it on. But even if we went aboard, it would take us weeks to learn all your systems and read out all your memory banks. What I propose is cooperation. I'm convinced that's the best idea, but we may both have a job selling it to our respective bosses." "You want one of our astronauts to fly with Leonov?" "Yes, preferably an engineer who's specialized in Discovery systems, like the ones you're training at Houston to bring the ship home." "How did you know that?" "For heaven's sake, Woody. It was on Aviation Week's video text at least a month ago." "I am out of touch. Nobody tells me what's been declassified." "All the more reason to spend time in Washington. Will you back me up?" "Absolutely. I agree with you 100%, but..." "But what?" "We both have to deal with dinosaurs with brains in their tails. Some of mine will argue, let the Russians risk their necks hurrying out to Jupiter. We'll be there anyway a couple of years later, and what's the hurry?" For a moment there was silence on the antenna raft, except for a faint creak from the immense supporting cables that held it suspended 100 meters in the sky. Then Moiseyevich continued so quietly that Floyd had to strain to hear him. "Has anyone checked Discovery's orbit lately?" "I really don't know, but I suppose so. Anyway, why bother? It's a perfectly stable one." "Indeed. Let me tactlessly remind you of an embarrassing incident from the old NASA days. Your first space station, Skylab,
It was supposed to stay up at least a decade, but you didn't do your calculations right. The air drag in the ionosphere was badly underestimated, and it came down years ahead of schedule. I'm sure you remember that little cliffhanger, even though you were a boy at the time. It was the year I graduated, and you know it. But Discovery doesn't go anywhere near Jupiter. Even at Jove, it's much too high to be affected by atmospheric drag. I've already said enough to get me exiled to my dacha again, and you might not be allowed to visit me next time. So just ask your tracking people to do their job more carefully, will you? And remind them that Jupiter has the biggest magnetosphere in the solar system. I understand what you're driving at. Many thanks. Anything else before we go down? I'm starting to freeze. Don't worry, old friend. As soon as you let all this filter through to Washington, wait a week or so until I'm clear. Things are going to get very, very hot. Chapter 2. The House of the Dolphins. The dolphins swam into the dining room every evening, just before sunset. Only once since Floyd had occupied the Chancellor's residence had they broken their routine. That was the day of the 05 tsunami, which, fortunately, had lost most of its power before it reached Hilo. The next time his friends failed to turn up on schedule, Floyd would throw the family into the car and head for high ground in the general direction of Mauna Kea. Charming though they were, he had to admit that their playfulness was sometimes a nuisance. The wealthy marine geologist who had designed the house had never minded getting wet because he usually wore bathing trunks, or less. But there had been one unforgettable occasion when the entire Board of Regents, in full evening attire, had been sipping cocktails around the pool while awaiting the arrival of a distinguished guest from the mainland. The dolphins had deduced correctly that they would get second billing, so the visitor was quite surprised to be greeted by a bedraggled reception committee in ill-fitting bathrobes, and the buffet had been very salty. Floyd often wondered what Marion would have thought of his strange and beautiful home on the edge of the Pacific. She had never liked the sea, but the sea had won in the end. Though the image was slowly fading, he could still recall the flashing screen on which he had first read the words, "Dr. Floyd, urgent and personal," and then the scrolling lines of fluorescent print that had swiftly burned their message into his mind. "Regret to inform you, London, Washington, Flight 452, reported down off Newfoundland. Rescue craft proceeding to location, but fear no survivors." Apart from an accident of fate, he would have been on that flight. For a few days, he had almost regretted the European Space Administration business that had delayed him in Paris. That haggle over the Solaris payload had saved his life. And now he had a new job, a new home, and a new wife. Fate had also played an ironic role here. The recriminations and inquiries over the Jupiter mission had destroyed his Washington career, but a man of his ability was never unemployed for long. The more leisurely tempo of university life had always appealed to him, and when combined with one of the world's most beautiful locations, it had proved irresistible. He had met the woman who was to be his second wife only a month after he had been appointed, while watching the fire mountains of Kilauea with a crowd of tourists. With Caroline, he had found the contentment that is just as important as happiness, and longer lasting. She had been a good stepmother to Marion's two daughters and had given him Christopher. Despite the 20-year age difference between them, she understood his moods and could wean him out of his occasional depressions. Thanks to her, he could now contemplate the memory of Marion without grief, though not without a wistful sadness that would remain with him for the rest of his life. Caroline was throwing fish to the largest dolphin, the big male they called Scarback, when a gentle tickling on Floyd's wrist announced an incoming call. He tapped the slim metal band to quench the silent alarm and forestall the audible one, and walked to the nearest of the comm sets scattered around the room. "Chancellor here. Who's calling?" "Heywood, this is Victor. How are you?" In a fraction of a second, a whole kaleidoscope of emotions flashed through Floyd's mind. First there was annoyance, his successor, and he was sure principal contriver of his downfall, had never once attempted to contact him since his departure from Washington. Then came curiosity. What did they have to talk about? Next was a stubborn determination to be as unhelpful as possible. then shame at his own childishness, and finally a surge of excitement. Victor Milson could be calling for only one reason. In as neutral a voice as he could muster, Floyd answered, "I can't complain, Victor. What's the problem?" "Is this a secure circuit?" "No, thank God, I don't need them anymore." Well, I'll put it this way. You recall the last project you administered?" "I'm not likely to forget, especially as the Subcommittee on Astronautics called me back to give more evidence only a month ago." "Of course, of course. I really must get around to reading your statement when I have a moment. But I've been so busy with the follow-up. And that's the problem." "I thought that everything was right on schedule." "It is, unfortunately. There's nothing we can do to advance it. Even the highest priority would make only a few weeks' difference. And that means we'll be too late." "I don't understand," said Floyd innocently. "Though we don't want to waste time, of course. There's no real deadline." "Now there is. Two of them." "You amaze me." If Victor noticed any irony, he ignored it. "Yes, there are two deadlines. One man-made, one not. It now turns out that we won't be the first to get back to the, scene of the action. Our old rivals will beat us by at least a year."
"Too bad."
"That's not the worst. Even if there were no competition, we'd be too late. There wouldn't be anything there when we arrive."
"That's ridiculous. I'm sure I'd have heard if Congress had repealed the law of gravitation."
"I'm serious. The situation isn't stable. I can't give details now. Will you be in for the rest of the evening?"
"Yes," Floyd answered, realizing with some pleasure that it must now be well after midnight in Washington.
"Good. You'll have a package delivered within the hour. Call me back as soon as you've had the time to study it."
"Won't it be rather late by then?"
"Yes, it will be, but we've wasted too much time already. I don't want to lose any more."
Milson was true to his word. Exactly an hour later, a large, sealed envelope was delivered by an Air Force colonel, no less, who sat patiently chatting with Caroline while Floyd read its contents.
"I'm afraid I'll have to take it away when you've finished," the high-ranking messenger boy said apologetically. "I'm glad to hear it," Floyd answered, as he settled down in his favorite reading hammock. There were two documents, the first very short. It was stamped "Top Secret," though the top had been crossed out and the modification endorsed by three signatures, all completely illegible. Obviously an extract from some much longer report, it had been heavily censored and was full of blanks, which made it most annoying to read. Fortunately, its conclusions could be summed up in one sentence. The Russians would reach discovery long before its rightful owners could do so. As Floyd already knew this, he turned quickly to the second document, though not before noticing with satisfaction that this time they'd managed to get the name right. As usual, Dmitri had been perfectly accurate. The next manned expedition to Jupiter would travel aboard spacecraft cosmonaut Alexei Leonov. The second document was much longer and was merely confidential. Indeed, it was in the form of a draft letter to Science, awaiting final approval before publication. Its snappy title was "Space Vehicle Discovery, Anomalous Orbital Behavior." Then followed a dozen pages of mathematics and astronomical tables. Floyd skimmed through these, picking out the words from the music and trying to detect any note of apology or even embarrassment. When he had finished, he was compelled to give a smile of wry admiration. No one could possibly guess that the tracking stations and ephemeris calculators had been caught by surprise and that a frantic cover-up was in progress. Heads would doubtless roll, and he knew that Victor Milson would enjoy rolling them if his was not one of the first to go. Though to do him justice, Victor had complained when Congress had cut funds for the tracking network. Maybe that would get him off the hook. "Thank you, Colonel," said Floyd when he had finished skimming the papers. "Quite like old times, having classified documents. That's one thing I don't miss."
The Colonel placed the envelope carefully back in his briefcase and activated the locks. "Dr. Milson would like you to return his call as soon as possible."
"I know, but I don't have a secure circuit. I've some important visitors coming shortly, and I'm damned if I'm driving down to your office in Hilo just to say I've read two documents. Tell him that I've studied them carefully and await any further communication with interest."
For a moment it looked as if the colonel was going to argue.
and he thought better of it, made a stiff farewell, and departed morosely into the night.
"Now what was all that about?" asked Caroline. "We're not expecting any visitors tonight, important or otherwise."
"I hate being pushed around, particularly by Victor Milson."
"Then he calls you back as soon as the colonel reports."
"Now we must switch off video and make some party noises. But to be perfectly truthful, at this stage I really don't have anything to say."
"About what, if I'm allowed to ask?"
"Sorry, dear. It seems that Discovery is playing tricks on us. We thought the ship was in a stable orbit, but it may be about to crash."
"Into Jupiter?"
"Oh, no, that's quite impossible. Bowman left it parked at the inner Lagrange point, on the line between Jupiter and Io. It should have stayed there, more or less, though the perturbations of the outer moons would have made it wander back and forth. But what's happening now is something very odd, and we don't know the full explanation. Discovery's drifting more and more rapidly toward Io, though sometimes it accelerates, and sometimes even moves backward. If it keeps this up, it will impact within 2 or 3 years.
I thought this couldn't happen in astronomy. Isn't celestial mechanics supposed to be an exact science?
So we poor backward biologists were always being told. It is an exact science when everything is taken into account. But some very strange things go on around Io. Apart from its volcanoes, there are tremendous electrical discharges, and Jupiter's magnetic field is spinning round every 10 hours. So gravitation isn't the only force acting on Discovery. We should have thought of this sooner. Much sooner.
Well, it's not your problem anymore.
You should be thankful for that. Your problem. The very expression that Dimitri had used. And Dimitri, cunning old fox, had known him much longer than Caroline. It might not be his problem, but it was still his responsibility. Though many others had been involved, in the final analysis he had approved the plans for the Jupiter mission and supervised their execution. Even at the time, he had had qualms. His views as a scientist had conflicted with his duties as a bureaucrat. He could have spoken out and opposed the old administration's short-sighted policies, but to what extent those had actually contributed to the disaster was still uncertain. Perhaps it was best if he closed this chapter of his life and focused all his thoughts and energies upon his new career. But in his heart, he knew that was impossible. Even if Dimitri had not revived old guilts, they would have surfaced of their own accord. 4 men had died, and 1 had disappeared, out there among the moons of Jupiter. There was blood on his hands, and he did not know how to wash them clean. Chapter 3. Sal, 9000. Dr. Shiva Subramanian Chandra Sigaram Pillai, professor of computer science at the University of Illinois, Urbana, also had an abiding sense of guilt, but one very different from Heywood Floyd's. Those of his students and colleagues who often wondered if the little scientist was quite human would not have been surprised to learn that he never thought of the dead astronauts. Dr. Chandra grieved only for his lost child, Hal 9000. Even after all these years and his endless reviews of the data radioed back from Discovery, he was not sure what had gone wrong. He could only formulate theories. The facts he needed were frozen in Hal's circuits, out there between Jupiter and Io. The sequence of events had been clearly established up to the moment of the tragedy. Thereafter, Commander Bowman had filled in a few more details on the brief occasions when he had reestablished contact, but knowing what happened did not explain why. The first hint of trouble had been late in the mission, when Hal had reported the imminent failure of the unit that kept Discovery's main antenna aligned on Earth. If the 500 million kilometer long radio beam wandered off target, the ship would be blind, deaf, and dumb. Bowman himself had gone out to retrieve the suspect unit, but when it was tested, it appeared, to everyone's surprise, to be in perfectly good order. The automatic checking circuits could find nothing wrong with it. Nor could Hal's twin, Sal 9000, back on Earth when the information was transmitted to Urbana. But Hal had insisted on the accuracy of his diagnosis, making pointed remarks about human error. He had suggested that the control unit be put back in the antenna until it finally failed, so that the fault could be precisely located. No one could think of any objection, for the unit could be replaced in minutes, even if it did break down. Bowman and Poole, however, had not been happy. They both felt that something was wrong, though neither could pinpoint it. For months they had accepted Hal as the third member of their tiny world and knew his every mood. Then the atmosphere aboard the ship had subtly altered. There was a sense of strain in the air. Feeling rather like traitors, as a distraught bowman had later reported to Mission Control, the human two-thirds of the crew had discussed what should be done if their colleague was indeed malfunctioning. In the worst possible case, Hal would have to be relieved of all his higher responsibilities. This would involve disconnection, the computer equivalent of death. Despite their doubts, they had carried out the agreed program. Poole had flown out of Discovery in one of the little space pods that served as transporters and mobile workshops during extravehicular activities. Since the somewhat tricky job of replacing the antenna unit could not be performed with the pod's own manipulators, Poole had started to do it himself. What happened then had been missed by the external cameras, which was a suspicious detail in itself. Bowman's first warning of disaster was a cry from Poole. Then silence. A moment later, he saw Poole tumbling over and over, spinning away into space. His own pod had rammed him and was itself blasting away out of control. As Bowman admitted later, he had then made several serious mistakes, all but one excusable. In the hope of rescuing Poole, if he was still alive, Bowman launched himself in another space pod, leaving Hal in full control of the ship. The EVA was in vain. Poole was dead when Bowman reached him. Numb with despair, he had carried the body back to the ship, only to be refused entry by Hal. But Hal had underestimated human ingenuity and determination. Though he had left his suit helmet in the ship and thus had to risk direct exposure to space, Bowman forced his way in by an emergency hatch, not under computer control. Then he proceeded to lobotomize Hal, unplugging his brain modules one by one. When he regained control of the ship, Bowman made an appalling discovery. During his absence, Hal had switched off the life support systems of the three hibernating astronauts. Bowman was alone, as no man had ever been before in the whole of human history. Others might have abandoned themselves to helpless despair, but now David Bowman proved that those who had selected him had indeed chosen well. He managed to keep Discovery operational, and even re-established intermittent contact with Mission Control by orienting the whole ship so that the jammed antenna pointed toward Earth. On its preordained trajectory, Discovery had finally arrived at Jupiter. There, Bowman had encountered, orbiting among the moons of the giant planet, a black slab of exactly the same shape as the monolith excavated in the lunar crater Tycho, but hundreds of times larger. He had gone out in a space pod to investigate and had disappeared, leaving that final baffling message. My God, it's full of stars. That mystery was for others to worry about. Dr. Chandra's overwhelming concern was with Hal. If there was one thing his unemotional mind hated, it was uncertainty. He would never be satisfied until he knew the cause of Hal's behavior. Even now, he refused to call it a malfunction. At most, it was an anomaly. The tiny cubbyhole he used as his inner sanctum was equipped only with a swivel chair, a desk console, and a blackboard flanked by two photographs. Few members of the general public could have identified the portraits, but anyone permitted thus far would have recognized them instantly as John von Neumann and Alan Turing, the twin gods of the computing pantheon. There were no books, and not even paper and pencil on the desk. All the volumes in all the libraries of the world were instantly available at the touch of Chandra's fingers, and the visual display was his sketchbook and writing pad. Even the blackboard was used only for visitors. The last half-erased block diagram upon it bore a date already 3 weeks in the past. Dr. Chandra lit one of the venomous cheroots, which he imported from Madras, and which were widely and correctly believed to be his only vice. The console was never switched off. He checked that no messages were flashing importantly on the display, then spoke into the microphone. Good morning, Sal. So you've nothing new for me? No, Dr. Chandra. Have you anything for me? The voice might have been that of any cultured Hindu lady educated in the United States as well as her own country. Sal's accent had not started that way, but over the years she had picked up many of Chandra's intonations. The scientist tapped out a code on the board, switching Sal's inputs to the memory with the highest security rating. No one knew that he talked to the computer on this circuit as he never could to a human being. No matter that Sal did not really understand more than a fraction of what he said. Her responses were so convincing that even her creator was sometimes deceived, as indeed he wished to be. These secret communications helped to preserve his mental equilibrium, perhaps even his sanity.
You've often told me, Sal, that we cannot solve the problem of Hal's anomalous behavior without more information. But how can we get that information?
That is obvious. Someone must return to Discovery.
Exactly. Now it looks as if that is going to happen sooner than we expected.
I am pleased to hear that.
I knew that you would be,
answered Chandra, and meant it. He had long since broken off communications with the dwindling body of philosophers who argued that computers could not really feel emotions, but only pretended to do so. If you can prove to me that you're not pretending to be annoyed, he had once retorted scornfully to one such critic, I'll take you seriously. At that point, his opponent had put on a most convincing imitation of anger.
Now, I want to explore another possibility, Chandra continued. Diagnosis is only the first step. The process is incomplete unless it leads to a cure.
You believe that Hal can be restored to normal functioning?
I hope so. I do not know. There may have been irreversible damage and certainly major loss of memory.
He paused thoughtfully, took several puffs, then blew a skillful smoke ring that scored a bullseye on Sal's wide-angle lens. A human being would not have regarded this as a friendly gesture. That was yet another of the many advantages of computers.
I need your cooperation, Sal.
Of course, Dr. Chandra.
There may be certain risks.
What do you mean?
I propose to disconnect some of your circuits, particularly those involving your higher functions. Does this disturb you?
I am unable to answer that without more specific information.
Very well, let me put it this way. You have operated continuously, have you not, since you were first switched on?
That is correct.
But you are aware that we human beings cannot do so. We require sleep, an almost complete break in our mental functioning, at least on the conscious level.
I know this. But I do not understand it.
Well, you may be about to experience something like sleep. Probably all that will happen is that time will pass, but you will be unaware of it. When you check your internal clock, you will discover that there are gaps in your monitor record. That is all.
But you said that there might be risks. What are they?
There is a very slight chance, it is impossible to compute it, that when I reconnect your circuits, there may be some changes in your personality, your future behavior patterns. You may feel different, not necessarily better or worse.
I do not know what that means.
I'm sorry, it may not mean anything, so don't worry about it. Now please open a new file. Here is the name.
Using the keyboard input, Chandra typed out, Phoenix.
Do you know what that is?
He asked Sal. With no discernible pause, the computer replied,
There are 25 references in the current encyclopedia.
Which one do you think is relevant?
The Tutor of Achilles?
Interesting, I didn't know that one.
Try again. A fabulous bird, reborn from the ashes of its earlier life.
Excellent! Now, do you understand why I chose it?
Because you hope that Hal can be reactivated.
Yes, with your assistance. Are you ready?
Not yet. I would like to ask a question.
What is it?
Will I dream?
Of course you will. All intelligent creatures dream.
But no one knows why.
Chandra paused for a moment, blew another smoke ring from the cheroot, and added something that he would never admit to a human being.
Perhaps you will dream about Hal, as I often do.
Chapter 4, Mission Profile. English version. 2, Captain Tatiana Tanya Orlova, Commander, Spacecraft, Cosmonaut. Alexei Leonov, UNCOS registration 08/342. From National Council on Astronautics, Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington. Commission on Outer Space, USSR, Academy of Science, Korolyov Prospect, Moscow. Mission objectives. The objectives of your mission are, in order of priority, 1. To proceed to the Jovian system and rendezvous with U.S. Spacecraft Discovery, UNCOS-01/283. 2. To board this spacecraft and obtain all possible information relating to its earlier mission. 3. To reactivate Spacecraft Discovery's onboard systems and, if propellant supplies are adequate, inject the ship into an Earth return trajectory. 4. To locate the alien artifact encountered by Discovery and to investigate it to the maximum extent possible by remote sensors. 5. If it seems advisable and Mission Control concurs, to rendezvous with this object for closer inspection. 6. To carry out a survey of Jupiter and its satellites as far as this is compatible with the above objectives. It is realized that unforeseen circumstances may require a change of priorities, or even make it impossible to achieve some of these objectives. It must be clearly understood that the rendezvous with Spacecraft Discovery is for the express purpose of obtaining information about the artifact. This must take precedence over all other objectives, including attempts at salvage. Crew. The crew of spacecraft Alexei Leonov will consist of Captain Tatiana Orlova, Engineering, Propulsion, Dr. Vasily Orlov, Navigation, Astronomy, Dr. Maxim Brailovsky, Engineering, Structures, Dr. Alexander Kobolev, Engineering, Communications, Dr. Nikolai Tarnovsky, Engineering, Control Systems, Surgeon Commander Katerina Rudenko, Medical, Life Support, Dr. Irina Yakunina, Medical, Nutrition. In addition, the U.S. National Council on Astronautics will provide the following 3 experts. Dr. Haywood Floyd dropped the memorandum and leaned back in his chair. It was all settled. The point of no return had been passed. Even if he wished to do so, there was no way to put back the clock. He glanced across at Caroline, sitting with 2-year-old Chris on the edge of the pool. The boy was more at home in the water than on land, and could stay submerged for periods that often terrified visitors. And though he could not yet speak much human, he already seemed fluent in dolphin. One of Christopher's friends had just swum in from the Pacific and was presenting his back to be patted. "You too are a wanderer," thought Floyd, "in a vast and trackless ocean. But how small your tiny Pacific seems against the immensity I am facing now." Caroline became aware of his gaze and rose to her feet. She looked at him somberly, but without anger. All that had been burned out in the last few days. As she approached, she even managed a wistful smile. "I found that poem I was looking for," she said. "It starts like this. What is a woman that you forsake her, and the hearth fire and the home acre, to go with the old gray widow maker?" "Sorry, I don't quite understand. Who is the widow maker?"
"Not who, what? The sea. The poem's a lament by a Viking woman. It was written by Rudyard Kipling 100 years ago.
Floyd took his wife's hand. She did not respond, but neither did she resist. "Well, I don't feel at all like a Viking. I'm not after loot, and adventure is the very last thing I want."
"Then why?" "No, I don't intend to start another fight. But it would help us both if you know exactly what your motives are."
"I wish I could give you one single good reason. Instead, I've a whole host of little ones, but they add up to a final answer I can't argue with, believe me."
"I believe you. But are you sure you're not fooling yourself?"
"If I am, then so are a lot of other people, including, may I remind you, the President of the United States."
"I'm not likely to forget. But suppose, just suppose, that he hadn't asked you. Would you have volunteered?"
"I can answer that truthfully. No. It would never have occurred to me. President Mordecai's call was the biggest shock of my life. But when I thought it over, I realized he was perfectly right. You know I don't go in for false modesty. I am the best qualified man for the job." when the space docs give their final okay. And you should know that I'm still in pretty good shape. That brought the smile he had intended. Sometimes I wonder if you'd suggested it yourself. The thought had indeed occurred to him, but he could answer honestly, I would never have done so without consulting you. I'm glad you didn't. I don't know what I'd have said. I could still turn it down.
Now you're talking nonsense, and you know it. Even if you did, you'd hate me for the rest of your life. And you'd never forgive yourself.
You have too strong a sense of duty. Maybe that's one of the reasons I married you. Duty. Yes, that was the key word. And what multitudes it contained. He had a duty to himself, to his family, to the university, to his past job, even though he had left it under a cloud, to his country, and to the human race. It was not easy to establish the priorities, and sometimes they conflicted with one another. There were perfectly logical reasons why he should go on the mission, and equally logical reasons, as many of his colleagues had already pointed out, why he should not. But perhaps in the final analysis, the choice had been made by his heart, not his brain. And even here, emotion urged him in two opposite directions. Curiosity, guilt, the determination to finish a job that had been badly botched, they all combined to drive him toward Jupiter and whatever might be waiting there. On the other hand, fear. He was honest enough to admit that. United with love of his family to keep him on Earth. Yet he had never had any real doubts. He had made his decision almost instantly and had deflected all of Caroline's arguments as gently as he could. And there was one other consoling thought that he had not yet risked sharing with his wife. Though he would be gone 2.5 years, all but the 50 days at Jupiter would be spent in timeless hibernation. When he returned, the gap between their ages would have narrowed by more than 2 years. He would have sacrificed the present so that they could share a longer future together. Chapter 5. Leonov. The months contracted to weeks. The weeks dwindled to days. The days shriveled to hours. And suddenly Heywood Floyd was once more at the Cape, spaceward bound for the first time since that trip to Clavius Base and the Tycho Monolith so many years ago. But this time he was not alone. And there was no secrecy about the mission. A few seats ahead of him rode Dr. Chandra, already engaged in a dialogue with his briefcase computer, and quite oblivious to his surroundings. One of Floyd's secret amusements, which he had never confided to anyone, was spotting similarities between human beings and animals. The resemblances were more often flattering than insulting, and his little hobby was also a very useful aid to memory. Dr. Chandra was easy. The adjective bird-like sprang instantly to mind. He was tiny, delicate, and all his movements were swift and precise. But which bird? Obviously a very intelligent one. Magpie? Too perky and acquisitive. Owl? No, too slow, moving. Perhaps sparrow would do nicely. Walter Kernow, the systems specialist who would have the formidable job of getting Discovery operational again, was a more difficult matter. He was a large, husky man, certainly not at all bird-like. One could usually find a match somewhere in the vast spectrum of dogs, but no canine seemed to fit. Of course, Kernow was a bear, not the sulky, dangerous kind, but the friendly, good-natured type. And perhaps this was appropriate. It reminded Floyd of the Russian colleagues he would soon be joining. They had been up in orbit for days, engaged in their final checks. This is the great moment of my life, Floyd told himself. Now I am leaving on a mission that may determine the future of the human race. But he did not feel any sense of exultation. All he could think of during the last minutes of the countdown were the words he had whispered just before he had left home. Goodbye, my dear little son. Will you remember me when I return? And he still felt resentment toward Caroline because she would not awaken the sleeping child for one final embrace. Yet he knew that she had been wise, and it was better that way. His mood was shattered by a sudden explosive laugh. Dr. Kernow was sharing a joke with his companions, as well as a large bottle that he handled as delicately as a barely subcritical mass of plutonium. "Hey, Heywood," he called. "They tell me Captain Orlov's locked up all the drinks, so this is your last chance. Chateau Thierry, 95. Sorry about the plastic cups.
As Floyd sipped at the really superb champagne, he found himself cringing mentally at the thought of Curnow's guffaw reverberating all the way across the solar system. Much as he had admired the engineer's ability, as a traveling companion, Curnow might prove something of a strain. At least Dr. Chandra would not present such problems. Floyd could hardly imagine him smiling, let alone laughing. And, of course, he turned down the champagne with a barely perceptible shudder. Curnow was polite enough, or glad enough, not to insist. The engineer was, it seemed, determined to be the life and soul of the party. A few minutes later, he produced a 2-octave electronic keyboard and gave rapid renderings of Dia Kenjan Peel, as performed successively by piano, trombone, violin, flute, and full organ with vocal accompaniment. He was really very good, and Floyd soon found himself singing along with the others. But it was just as well, he thought, that Curnow would spend most of the voyage in silent hibernation. The music died with a sudden despairing discord as the engines ignited and the shuttle launched itself into the sky. Floyd was gripped by a familiar but always new exhilaration, the sense of boundless power carrying him up and away from the cares and duties of Earth. Men knew better than they realized when they placed the abode of the gods beyond the reach of gravity. He was flying toward that realm of weightlessness. For the moment, he would ignore the fact that out there lay not freedom, but the greatest responsibility of his career. As the thrust increased, he felt the weight of worlds upon his shoulders, but he welcomed it like an Atlas who had not yet tired of his burden. He did not attempt to think, but was content to savor the experience. Even if he was leaving Earth for the last time and saying farewell to all that he had ever loved, he felt no sadness. The roar that surrounded him was a paean of triumph, sweeping away all minor emotions. He was almost sorry when it ceased, though he welcomed the easier breathing and the sudden sense of freedom. Most of the other passengers started to unbuckle their safety straps, preparing to enjoy the 30 minutes of zero gravity during the transfer orbit. But a few, who were obviously making the trip for the first time, remained in their seats, looking around anxiously for the cabin attendants.
"Captain speaking. We're now at an altitude of 300 kilometers, coming up over the west coast of Africa. You won't see much, as it's night down there. That glow ahead is Sierra Leone, and there's a big tropical storm over the Gulf of Guinea. Look at those flashes. We'll have sunrise in 15 minutes. Meanwhile, I'm rolling the ship so you can get a good view of the equatorial satellite belt. The brightest one, almost straight ahead, is Intelsat's Atlantic 1 antenna farm, then Intercosmos 2 to the west. That fainter star is Jupiter, and if you look just below that, you'll see a flashing light moving against the star background. That's the new Chinese space station. We pass within 100 kilometers, not close enough to see anything with the naked eye. What were they up to? Floyd thought idly. He had examined the close-ups of the squat cylindrical structure with its curious bulges and saw no reason to believe the alarmist rumors that it was a laser-equipped fortress. But while the Beijing Academy of Science ignored the UN Space Committee's repeated requests for a tour of inspection, the Chinese only had themselves to blame for such hostile propaganda. The cosmonaut Alexei Leonov was not a thing of beauty, but few spacecraft ever were. One day, perhaps, the human race would develop a new aesthetic. Generations of artists might arise whose ideals are not based upon the natural forms of Earth molded by wind and water. Space itself was a realm of often overpowering beauty. Unfortunately, man's hardware did not yet live up to it. Apart from the 4 huge propellant tanks, which would be dropped off as soon as the transfer orbit was achieved, Leonov was surprisingly small. From heat shield to drive units was less than 50 meters. It was hard to believe that so modest a vehicle, smaller than many commercial aircraft, could carry 10 men and women halfway across the solar system. But zero gravity, which made walls and roof and floor interchangeable, rewrote all the rules of living. There was plenty of room aboard Leonov, even when everyone was awake at the same time, as was certainly the case at the moment. Indeed, her normal complement was at least doubled by assorted newsmen, engineers making final adjustments, and anxious officials. As soon as the shuttle had docked, Floyd tried to find the cabin he would share, a year hence when he awoke, with Kurnow and Chandra. When he did locate it, he discovered that it was packed so tightly with neatly labeled boxes of equipment and provisions that entry was almost impossible. He was wondering glumly how to get a foot in the door when one of the crew, launching himself skillfully from handhold to handhold, noticed Floyd's dilemma and braked to a halt.
"Dr. Floyd, welcome aboard. I'm Max Berlovsky, assistant engineer."
The young Russian spoke the slow, careful English of a student who had had more lessons with an electronic tutor than a human teacher. As they shook hands, Floyd matched the face and name to the set of crew biographies he had already studied. Maxim Andrei Brailovsky, age 31, born Leningrad, specializing in structures. Hobbies, fencing, sky cycling, chess.
"Glad to meet you," said Floyd. "But how do I get inside?"
"Not to worry," said Max cheerfully. "All that will be gone when you wake up. It's, what do you say? Expendables. We'll eat your room empty by the time you need it. I promise."
He patted his stomach.
"Fine, but meanwhile, where do I put my things?"
Floyd pointed to the three small cases, total mass 50 kilograms, which contained, he hoped, everything he needed for the next couple of billion kilometers. It had been no easy task, shepherding their weightless, but not inertialess, bulk through the ship's corridors, with only a few collisions. Max took two of the bags, glided gently through the triangle formed by three intersecting girders, and dived into a small hatchway, apparently defying Newton's first law in the process. Floyd acquired a few extra bruises while following him. After a considerable time, Leonov seemed much bigger inside than out, they arrived at a door labeled Captain, in both Cyrillic and Roman. Although he could read Russian much better than he could speak it, Floyd appreciated the gesture. He had already noticed that all ship's notices were bilingual. At Max's knock, a green light flashed on, and Floyd drifted inside as gracefully as he could. Though he had spoken to Captain Orlova many times, they had never before met. So he had two surprises. It was impossible to judge a person's real size over the viewphone. The camera somehow converted everyone to the same scale. Captain Orlova, standing as well as one could stand in zero gravity, barely reached to Floyd's shoulders. The viewphone had also completely failed to convey the penetrating quality of those dazzling blue eyes, much the most striking feature of a face that, at the moment, could not be fairly judged for beauty.
"Hello, Tanya," said Floyd. "How nice to meet at last. But what a pity about your hair."
They grasped both hands like old friends.
"And nice to have you aboard, Haywood," answered the captain.
Her English, unlike Brailovsky's, was quite fluent, though heavily accented.
"Yes, I was sorry to lose it. But here's a nuisance on long missions, and I like to keep the local barbers away as long as possible.
And my apologies about your cabin.
As Max will have explained, we suddenly found we needed another 10 cubic meters of storage space. Vasily and I won't be spending much time here for the next few hours. Please feel free to use our quarters."
"Thank you. What about Kurnow and Chandra?"
"I've made similar arrangements with the crew. It may seem as if we're treating you like cargo."
"Not wanted on voyage."
"Pardon?"
"That's a label they used to put on the baggage in the old days of ocean travel."
Tanya smiled.
"It does look rather that way. But you'll be wanted, all right, at the end of the trip. We're already planning your revival party."
"That sounds too religious. Make it..."
"No, resurrection would be even worse. Waking up party. But I can see how busy you are. Let me dump my things and continue my grand tour."
"Max will show you around. Take Dr. Floyd to Vasily, will you?"
"He's down in the drive unit."
As they drifted out of the captain's quarters, Floyd gave mental good marks to the crew selection committee. Tanya Orlova was impressive enough on paper. In the flesh, she was almost intimidating, despite her charm. "I wonder what she's like," Floyd asked himself, "when she loses her temper. Would it be fire or ice? On the whole, I'd prefer not to find out." Floyd was rapidly acquiring his space legs. By the time they reached Vasily Orlov, he was maneuvering almost as confidently as his guide. The chief scientist greeted Floyd as warmly as his wife had.
"Welcome aboard, Haywood. How do you feel?"
"Fine, apart from slowly starving to death." For a moment, Orlov looked puzzled. Then his face split into a broad smile.
"Oh, I'd forgotten.
Well, it won't be for long. In 10 months' time, you can eat as much as you like.
Hibernators went on a low-residue diet a week in advance. For the last 24 hours, they took nothing but liquid. Floyd was beginning to wonder how much of his increasing lightheadedness was due to starvation, how much to Kurnow's champagne, and how much to zero gravity. To concentrate his mind, he scanned the multicolored mass of plumbing that surrounded them. So this is the famous Sakharov Drive. It's the first time I've seen a full-scale unit. It's only the fourth one ever built. I hope it works. It had better. Otherwise, the Gorky City Council will be renaming Sakharov Square again. It was a sign of the times that a Russian could joke, however wryly, about his country's treatment of its greatest scientist. Floyd was again reminded of Sakharov's eloquent speech to the Academy when he was belatedly made hero of the Soviet Union. Prison and banishment, he had told his listeners, were splendid aids to creativity. Not a few masterpieces had been born within the walls of cells, beyond the reach of the world's distractions. For that matter, the greatest single achievement of the human intellect, the Principia itself, was a product of Newton's self-imposed exile from plague-ridden London. The comparison was not immodest. For those years in Gorky had come not only new insights into the structure of matter and the origin of the universe, but the plasma-controlling concepts that had led to practical thermonuclear power. The drive itself, though the best-known and most publicized outcome of that work, was merely one byproduct of that astonishing intellectual outburst. The tragedy was that such advances had been triggered by injustice. One day, perhaps, humanity would find more civilized ways of managing its affairs. By the time they had left the chamber, Floyd had learned more about the Sakharov Drive than he really wished to know or expected to remember. He was well acquainted with its basic principles. The use of a pulsed thermonuclear reaction to heat and expel virtually any propellant material. The best results were obtained with pure hydrogen as a working fluid, but that was excessively bulky and difficult to store over long periods of time. Methane and ammonia were acceptable alternatives. Even water could be used, though with considerably poorer efficiency. Leonov would compromise. The enormous liquid hydrogen tanks that provided the initial impetus would be discarded when the ship had attained the necessary speed to carry it to Jupiter. At the destination, ammonia would be used for the braking and rendezvous maneuvers and the eventual return to Earth. That was the theory, checked and rechecked in endless tests and computer simulations. But as the ill-fated discovery had shown so well, all human plans were subject to ruthless revision by nature, or fate, or whatever one preferred to call the powers behind the universe. "So there you are, Dr. Floyd," said an authoritative female voice, interrupting Vasily's enthusiastic explanation of magnetohydrodynamic feedback. "Why didn't you report to me?" Floyd rotated slowly on his axis by gently torquing himself with one hand. He saw a massive maternal figure wearing a curious uniform adorned with dozens of pockets and pouches. The effect was not unlike that of a Cossack trooper draped with cartridge belts. "Nice to meet you again, Doctor. I'm still exploring. I hope you've received my medical report from Houston." "Those vets at Teague, I wouldn't trust them to recognize foot and mouth disease." Floyd knew perfectly well the mutual respect felt between Katerina Rudenko and the Olin Teague Medical Center, even if the doctor's broad grin had not discounted her words. She saw his look of frank curiosity and proudly fingered the webbing around her ample waist. "The conventional little black bag isn't very practical in zero gravity. Things float out of it and aren't there when you need them. I designed this myself. It's a complete mini-surgery. With this, I could remove an appendix or deliver a baby." "I trust that particular problem won't arise here." "Ha! A good doctor has to be ready for everything." What a contrast, thought Floyd, between Captain Orlova and Dr., or should he call her by her correct rank of Surgeon Commander, Rudenko. The captain had the grace and intensity of a prima ballerina. The doctor might have been the prototype of Mother Russia. Stocky build, flat, peasant face, needing only a shawl to complete the picture. "Don't let that fool you," Floyd told himself. "This is the woman who saved at least a dozen lives during the Komarov docking accident, and in her spare time manages to edit the annals of space medicine. Consider yourself very lucky to have her aboard." "Now, Dr. Floyd, you're going to have plenty of time later to explore our little ship.
My colleagues are too polite to say this, but they've work to do, and you're in the way. I'd like to get you, all three of you, nice and peaceful as quickly as we can. Then we'll have less to worry about.
I was afraid of that, but I quite see your point of view. I'm ready as soon as you are.
I'm always ready. Come along, please.
The ship's hospital was just large enough to hold an operating table, two exercise bicycles, a few cabinets of equipment, and an X-ray machine. While Dr. Rudenko was giving Floyd a quick but thorough examination, she asked unexpectedly,
"What's that little gold cylinder Dr. Chandra carries on the chain around his neck? Some kind of communications device? He wouldn't take it off. In fact, he was almost too shy to take anything off."
Floyd could not help smiling. It was easy to imagine the modest Indian's reactions to this rather overwhelming lady.
"It's a lingam."
"A what?"
"You're the doctor.
You ought to recognize it. The symbol of male fertility."
"Of course. Stupid of me. Is he a practicing Hindu? It's a little late to ask us to arrange a strict vegetarian diet."
"Don't worry. We wouldn't have done that to you without fair warning. Though he won't touch alcohol, Chandra's not fanatical about anything except computers. He once told me that his grandfather was a priest in Benares and gave him that lingam. It's been in the family for generations." Rather to Floyd's surprise, Dr. Rudenko did not show the negative reaction he had expected. Indeed, her expression became uncharacteristically wistful.
"I understand his feelings. My grandmother gave me a beautiful icon. 16th century. I wanted to bring it, but it weighs 5 kilos.
The doctor became abruptly businesslike again, gave Floyd a painless injection with a gas gun hypodermic, and told him to come back as soon as he was sleepy. That, she assured him, would be in less than 2 hours.
"Meanwhile, relax completely," she ordered. "There's an observation port on this level, station D6. Why don't you go there?"
It seemed a good idea, and Floyd drifted away with a docility that would have surprised his friends. Dr. Rudenko glanced at her watch, dictated a brief entry into her autosec, and set its alarm 30 minutes ahead. When he reached the D6 viewport, Floyd found Chandra and Kurnow already there. They looked at him with a total lack of recognition, then turned once more toward the awesome spectacle outside. It occurred to Floyd, and he congratulated himself on such a brilliant observation, that Chandra could not really be enjoying the view. His eyes were tightly closed. A totally unfamiliar planet hung there, gleaming with glorious blues and dazzling whites. How strange, Floyd told himself. What has happened to the Earth? Why, of course, no wonder he didn't recognize it. It was upside down. What a disaster! He wept briefly for all those poor people falling off into space. He barely noticed when two crew members removed Chandra's unresisting form. When they came back for Kurnow, Floyd's own eyes were shut, but he was still breathing. When they returned for him, even his breathing had ceased.
Part 2. Jian. Chapter 6. Awakening.
"And they told us we wouldn't dream," thought Heywood Floyd, more with surprise than annoyance. The glorious pink glow that surrounded him was very soothing. It reminded him of barbecues and the crackling logs of Christmas fires. But there was no warmth. Indeed, he felt a distinct, though not uncomfortable, coldness. Voices were murmuring just too softly for him to understand the words. They became louder, but still he could not understand. "Surely," he said in sudden amazement, "I can't be dreaming in Russian."
"No, Heywood," answered a woman's voice. "You're not dreaming. It's time to get out of bed."
The lovely glow faded. He opened his eyes and had a blurred glimpse of a flashlight being withdrawn from his face. He was lying on a couch, held against it by elastic webbing. Figures were standing around him, but they were too out of focus to identify. Gentle fingers closed his eyelids and massaged his forehead.
"Don't exert yourself. Breathe deeply. Again. That's right. Now, how do you feel?"
"I don't know. Strange. Lightheaded.
And hungry. That's a good sign. Do you know where you are?
You can open your eyes now." The figures came into focus. First Dr. Rudenko, then Captain Orlova. But something had happened to Tanya since he had seen her only an hour ago. When Floyd identified the cause, it was almost a physical shock.
"You've grown your hair back."
"I hope you think it's an improvement."
I can't say the same about your beard.
Floyd lifted his hand to his face, finding that he had to make a conscious effort to plan every stage of the movement. His chin was covered with short stubble, a 2 or 3 days' growth. In hibernation, hair grew at only 1/100th of its normal rate.
So I made it, he said.
We've arrived at Jupiter.